the space.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. But you know, it's those kinds of things you got to watch out for.
Yeah, that's for sure. I am in agreement with you entirely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did Chandra, did the rest of the people come on board?
Looks like we have six of us here. I think Nancy's probably still trying to work on connecting. And Bill Chapman will probably won't be joining us today due to the time change. He's in Thailand, I believe. So,
My goodness, yeah.
But I think we have quorum, so we could go ahead and start, and hopefully Nancy will be able to connect. Okay, I'd like to call this meeting to order. Before we do approval of, sorry, anybody have something? Before we do approval of the minutes, I wanted to propose that we add a few things to this agenda. First is that later on that someone would make a motion for the to have their limited meeting. Also, I thought that we could possibly talk about when our next meetings might be in person, whether our next meeting might or whether it be further on, or if not, whether we might split the Friday meeting and have part on Thursday and part on Friday instead of using the Thursday for the virtual time. But this is some things we could just talk about. And the other thing I was going to suggest that we add is to discuss the results of the bill that changes the board number of board members from 10 to 7. So maybe could someone make a motion to add those things to the agenda?
I move that we add those items to the agenda.
Thanks, Pat.
Second.
All right, thank you, Pat. Okay, we'll move on to the approval of the meeting minutes. The first is the meeting minutes for the meeting from July 31st. Did anybody have any comments or revisions?
None for me.
Okay.
I move
Doctor,
to accept
yeah, go
the
ahead,
minutes,
Alton.
approve the minutes.
Seconded.
Okay. The minutes for the September 17th limited meeting. Does anybody have any comments or revisions?
I mean,
Shouldn't we vote to pass first?
Sorry, Alton? Oh.
Didn't we vote to
Yes,
pass?
I'm so sorry. Yes. All in favor of approval of the July 31st meeting minutes. Okay, we have six in favor. Sorry, now the minutes from September 17th. Any comments or revisions?
I move to accept as written.
Seconded.
Okay, all in favor of approving the September 17 minutes as received. Okay, approved. September 18th, the regular meeting minutes. Any comments or revisions? Okay, and would I like to make a motion?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Seconded.
Okay, thank you. All in favor of approval of the September 18 minutes? Six in favor. Approval of the March 4th limited meeting minutes. I noticed that these were not available online. So I actually don't have a copy of those. Did anybody
Actually,
else?
in the link that Chandra sent us a number of weeks ago, when I clicked on that, I actually got the minutes and I printed it then. So I'm not sure why, but that earlier one, it let me access them and print them.
I can send you one right now, Katie. Yeah, some people, I don't know why there were some issues with my drop my OneDrive, and some people couldn't get it.
Okay.
But Frank is working on it right now.
Okay. If you could send that to me, and then maybe we could just move this approval to a little bit later in the meeting because
Okay.
right now there's only six of us here. Thank you.
Okay, I'll send it right now.
Okay. And then approval or revisions for the March 5th regular meeting minutes. The
Move
only
to
comment,
approve.
I actually wanted to make a comment on that one. In the minutes, it doesn't say anything about that the Kubihau or Wailele project was removed from the list. And I wondered if maybe that should be reflected in the minutes, because it was on our agenda, but then because somebody, a property trustee, contacted SHPD and said that they did not know about the nomination, we actually removed it. So I'm wondering if possibly that should be added to the minutes.
I can add that to the minutes.
Okay, thank you, Chandra.
Thank you.
Can we, Dr. Downer, can we then approve the minutes if in with agreement that she would make that amendment?
Yes.
Okay. So somebody like to make a motion?
Motion to approve is amended.
Seconded.
All right. Thank you. All in favor of approving the minutes as amended, or as will be amended. Where is Bill Salsa? Is he still on? Oh, there you are. Okay, I see you, thanks. Okay, great. Okay, then we can move on to that. Move on to the nominations. Okay, our first here is the Otsubo Monument Works. That would be Laura Ruby.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm going to screen share, so bear with me for just a minute. I'm going to get it right. I think I'm going to. I'm not sure. Oh, gosh. I'm afraid this is makes it hard. Okay. Can you see the screen now, and can you hear me talk? Both.
Yep, we can.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. I have a few extensions of what I've said yesterday, so I hope that you folks who heard what I said yesterday will bear with me, and please, after I finish, if you want to have ask me questions or comments, I'd be very happy to receive them. So this is the Otsubo Monument Works. At Sentaro Otsubo is the founder of his monument works, a stone monument. You can't call it industry, I guess would be the best word. And he did many of the monuments, including Bamboo Ridge and the Hio monument that's across from Central Union, and probably most famously, but least recognized, the carving at Founders Gates at UH, where many of you might have attended and not possibly seen them, but they are there nevertheless. this is a large project which took me in many different research directions. Both a story of Sentaro Otsubo and his monument works, but also the discovery that he used of headstones in the pavement structure that came from another place, which was the Roman Catholic Cemetery. And the stones turned out to be very important Hawaiian people in the past. And two Hawaiian headstones recovered and are now at the Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery in honor of them. And this is a great historic story that's not really been explained, and I'm adding to it, I believe. So here's the sort of the works. Can you see my little cursor moving around? And you see my cursor on the screen?
Yes.
Yes.
This is the central focus, because from here everything goes outward. It goes through the history of the artifacts themselves, through Otsubo's time on his property, and then finally where they are now residing in the Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery. And I'll come back to that image again. Okay. And I'm going to read from some of the National Park Service Bulletin 16s, because I think this is very important. This is what we as nominators use to make sure that we covered all of our bases. And I think this is really important, and it's something you folks on the board may not necessarily need to do, but it is our due diligence that we try to do to make sure our nominations are complete. So I'm going to go read this. And so the definition where the historic property was constructed or the place where the historic event occurred, the combination of elements that create the form, plan, space, structure, and style of a property, the physical environment of a historic property. Setting includes elements such as topographic features, open space, view shed, landscape, vegetation, and artificial features. The physical elements that were combined or deposited during a particular period of time and in a particular pattern or configuration to form a historic property. The physical evidence of the labor and skill of a particular culture or people during any given period in history. A property's expression of the aesthetic or historic sense of a particular period of time. And this is included in the bulletin. They are places that are associated with the events that have made a significant contribution to the broad patterns of our history. This clearly ranges from the 1880s all the way through into the 2000s. B, that are associated with the lives of persons significant in our past, and D, that have yielded or may be likely to yield important information in prehistory or history. What I would like to take is just a moment of nominations that have been approved by this board or former boards for the Hawaii State Register of Historic Places and possibly also the National Register of Historic Places. And that is first Koho'olawe. I'm not sure that any remains at all are there, but it is considered a special site and was nominated and approved. Excuse me just a second. Hono'uli'uli, which is a series of pavements and some ditches and walls. Frigate Shoals, Two Brothers Shipwreck. That's and I know Susan Lebo's on the Zoom, and she did such a great presentation there of the shipwreck and all of its history, and then the artifacts that are now hidden because they're not identified as to where they are. Now they are nevertheless there, and that is a designated site. Cocoa Palms. I'm sorry. Cocoa Palms, which is was presented at the last time or two to your board, and it's designated really to be torn down and destroyed, and it will need another SHPD assessment before the destruction is done. And then also I added the Liliuokalani Botanical Gardens. That's in by Nu'uanu Stream by Kukini. This was actually a place where Liliuokalani had a garden. And it was, I believe, where the crown flowers were grown for her purposes when she was incarcerated. But there basically is nothing left of her gardens. It is now replanted by probably city and county. I'm not sure who's designated as the owner of the property as botanical garden. So it's entirely, it's a site, but it's a site that has entirely different meaning at this particular time. And finally, and there's probably many more, the Malia'koa canoe. And this now resides in the Canoe Halau at Alawai Park. However, it was made in Maui, created in Maui, I think in the 1930s, and moved to maybe several different places until finally it's residing in the Halau. But should it have to move again, it will be redesignated in another site. So it is an artifact that is a transportable artifact, if you want to call it that. So what I'm saying through all of this, presenting these five different examples, is that there are a lot of varieties of things that we call sites and things that should be designated through the SHPD process. And this is all of, and my application is in the criteria A with the history and events. So again, the Sumo Monument Works, the pavement structure, the two Hawaiian headstones. So, and here's again, just in case you want to see, I'm going to touch on all of these. So just to let you know, in case you didn't know, I'm wearing a t-shirt that says Mo'ili'ili. This is Mo'ili'ili. And this is again the designated area by them. And just to let you know, this is where the Otsubo monuments were and still partially and still buried by a slab. And then this is where the new home and permanent home of the Hawaiian artifacts, the two Hawaiian headstones reside. And this is a site map. I'm going to show you a close up, but this is the geology map that we use. It's a very substantial one when anybody is thinking about digging. And so this is its location right here. And this is on the karst. And the karst is visible all throughout the neighborhood. And of course, it is the place of Solution Caverns also. There's a lot more I could talk about that, but that's our project for today is about the actual site and the artifacts. This is from the Land Commission Awards designation, and this is the location. It's in Kapa'akea, Ili. It's in the larger Ahupua'a of Waikiki. And then the National Park Service overarching goals. The first is to state in chronological order in local and regional context. So I do that in all my nominations with a timetable, which gives the all of the various things that have happened throughout time that are important to the site or the artifacts in this case. Second is to reconstruct past life ways, including the ways that people made a living and the ways they used the landscape. And that's clearly with Mr. Otsubo's use of his property that was not in use previously to that time. And as I suggest in the nomination, it was basically non-productive agricultural land. And it was a property that he made very good use of in a growing town of Mo'ili'ili. The third is to achieve some understanding of how and why human societies have changed through time. And I think it's a very important development that it was Hawaiian in nature, became Japanese American as they moved into the community. And through time, Sentaro Otsubo collected things that would be profitable to his business. And this would be the disused headstones that would serve a new purpose as a pavement. So these are pictures of the Otsubo grounds. In the background, on the left, you can see punch bowl is behind you, and that's a well. And right in front here are the stones that he used for carving. And I bet the well pulley apparatus also served to move his stones. And this is his, on the right is his shed for tools and so forth. And this is an example of the entrance at the time of their house. Harriet Natsuyama is the oldest, and she might, I don't know who the baby is in there, but there were two boys in the family besides Harriet, and that's their plantation style home that was there. And this was the first day of discovery. Harriet called me up and said, "You've got to come quick. We found some headstones. We don't know what to do." And the contractor had lifted up, possibly breaking it at the time. We don't know if that was the case or not. But then we replaced them in the ground. And then at this particular point, thanks to Ross Stevenson, who I worked with on the Historic Honoka Town project, he contacted Susan Lebo, and she and Stephanie Hacker, I believe her last name is, came out and did a rough sketch of the location. And Susan went into the pit and excavated some things. And this is headstone one was Abigail Ellen Pony Kamakau, and the other one is Noah Kepokai. And Matajuro Arakawa is also another very historical headstone, although the recreation of it is over at the Makiki Cemetery now, along with the other Japanese sailors. But he was the first Japanese to be buried here in the 1800s. The other headstone is a blank. So here, whoops, what's happened? So these are the two headstones as they have been pulled out of the trenching, the excavation. And this is to say that we wanted to save these. We wanted to honor the people. They turned out to be way much, much more important to our historical knowledge than anything that I had known before. And this is because the Kamakau family, her father, was the great historian that recorded so much of what we now know and saved for posterity. And this is part of their family, and it really wasn't very much known. And Ke Poi Kai is also related to them. And you folks who've looked at the end of the one in the addendum with the genealogical chart will know that they are both directly related back to the Kipahulu Land Commission Award. And that was given there, and the property may, some property still may be in their hands. Anyway, to go on, I'll come back to that in a little bit. Let's see. Whoops, come on. Oh, I seem to have slipped out of my slide presentation. Just a second. Okay. Okay, you can see them better now, larger. And to let you know, Sentaro Otsubo found perfectly natural is to have adaptive reuse for the headstones, which are no longer used. This is an example of a military headstone that's at upon a chapel, which the chapel used to be here. And it's an example of how you take something that is now in disuse and adapt it for a better reuse. I might say that in the 80s and 90s, over at the University of Hawaii Art Department, I would see constantly, deliveries of headstones that were no longer in use. And they were put there for students to learn how to carve. They were largely limestone and marble ones as a softer stone that they could learn to carve on. So these are very common occurrences that people reuse their products that are on site. And then some of the stone characteristics, and I think this is important for people who are studying larger pictures of how cemeteries develop over time or what the type of carving is. And so the stone types went into, which is quite a bit with the hardness scales and the so forth, the types of pedestals and mountings to pedestals and why the stone pedestal attachments failed. And I think that's the key reason why the two headstones showed up in another place, basically, is because the attachments failed. And I can show you a picture of why the pins were not deep enough or large enough or strong enough to hold up these very, very heavy stones. And then the types, shape characteristics, the tympanum, that's the top part of the ornamentation on the headstones, the types of engraving and relief carving. Sentaro Otsubo was a master, and he does both, did both, I should say, and the types of messages that were put on there, and the death dates on the stones. So you can see the filigree work that's here. It's I don't think Sentaro Otsubo did not carve these. They might have been done by the mainland or someplace else. They're very atypical of all the other cemeteries that I went to investigate, but they are in keeping with being marble and being very large and none in the 1800s. So these are some of the cemeteries that I took Harriet to, and we investigated. We were looking for all the 1800 stones that are marble in origin or even other stones featured. And the assumption is the Roman Catholic cemetery is where they came from. And then these are just some pictures of the different cemeteries. You can see the different types of stone. When we at the Roman Catholic cemetery, this curbing compound is the Kamakau compound. Julia Kamakau is probably a younger daughter or niece of Abigail Ellen Kamakau, and related to the Kamakau family. What you can see in here, there's a tree that once was growing, it's been cut down, an unmarked cross, Julia's gravesite, and then there was a statue of some sort that was back here. But these two pedestal stones are the stones where Abigail Ellen Kamakau was buried, and Ke Poi Kai stone was also placed. And I might say that Ke Poi Kai, the the stone says in memory of, and this is different from the actual engraving site, Kepoikai's family, which is the Aluli family, Yuklin Aluli, some of you might know her, lawyer in town, she said that they had always heard that their relative was buried in the in Wailuku in Maui, which he did live all his life, but they do not know where the gravesite is. So finding this headstone was a really remarkable discovery that in the 1880s they had chosen to honor his memory, even though maybe his own gravesite was not found. And in Catholic tradition, there's no cremation, it's body burials. So I did measurements of the actual remaining lower pedestal, and then on top would have been the smaller supporting pedestal, which would have had the holes at the time. These are missing stones. They were probably not worthy of somebody's adaptive reuse. So if you notice this, it says with the Kepoikai, it says in memory of. That's a little bit different from the actual burial of Abigail Ellen Kamakau and everything. And he was born in Maui, born in Kaupipa. It's also Kaupipa, 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 different spellings for it, but it's basically in Kipahulu in the southern part of Maui. And here they are in a restored state at the Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery, being honored as they are a tremendous importance to the whole of history and events in the larger community of Hawaii. And this is to let you know, this is where they came from at the Kaupipa, and this is their land holdings were in this area here in Kipahulu. And then when they, Samuel Kamakau, the historian, decided at some point to move his family. It'd be after he was teacher at Lahaina Luna, went to Lahaina Luna and was teacher at Lahaina Luna for a short time, but then went to Kipahulu to be school teacher and also a principal at the school there. And at that time, it's at that point, probably he converted from did somebody say something? Okay. Converted from Congregationalist to Catholic. And at that point, he probably was also involved in the Catholic Church there in some restoration. His son, also named Samuel Kamakau, went there to restore a church. We don't know which one, but it probably was the Catholic Church. Also, you notice this is the Catholic cemetery right here in Honolulu, and that's where the actual stones were placed for the two individuals, Abigail Ellen and Noah Kepoikai. And this is where Samuel Kamakau moved his family. So this was a place of somewhat, I don't want to say wealthy people, but people that had more means than the people who moved in from neighboring rural islands and Hawaiian families all. And you'll note it's right near Queen's Hospital, right near Royal School. It was on Emma Street and all of the, and there's the Royal School right there and the heiau, which in that time, perhaps in the late 1800s would have been a very prominent site at that time. This is a fire map of the central fireplace. The fire station is here, and it just shows how far out they can go. And many of these names of the neighborhoods are now not in use. And this is my mapping of the Land Commission awards that were for basically for Hawaiian families that had moved into the area that claimed Land Commission awards here. So you can see this is the edge of, basically, if you can say it, there's an edge of Kaupipa, Kahuhina, Kahuhuna, sorry. And this is the compound where they lived. And this is the, Sanborn map, and you can see this is the location with, addresses were actually located. And so this is the actual compound. Maybe they even called it a kauhale. I don't know where the Kamakau family was. And then this is back to, this was the first installation of the two stones. And then this is the final way. And again, going back to how they look, the Kaupapa, Kipahulu Maui, both from born in Maui, Ke Poikai stayed in Maui, but his headstone in memory was put up at, in the Catholic cemetery. Abigail Ellen Kamakau, born on Maui, but died in Kahihuna. The family members, her father, the historian, also buried, not in the Catholic cemetery, but in Oahu Cemetery, which is a more neutral burial ground for people. And very interesting carving on the back and the front are his carving is on one side, and the other side is his wife, who passed away in 1905, much later than all of these others. But she was probably the keeper of the family tradition and so forth. And she's direct connection with the Ke Poikai family also. And then the Roman Catholic cemetery, which the bluestone curb enclosure and the pedestal stones still remain, through to the acquisition of Mr. Otsubo and his monument works industry. And to finally, when they were discovered, the Hawaiian headstones. And what I would like to say is that Susan Lebo, when Ross Stevenson asked her to come out, and she came out and she investigated, and I hope Susan will be able to get onto the Zoom also, because at that point she looked at everything and she said that there were no remains and that we could go ahead with the grease trap that was being designated there, and that she saw no particular reason for any kind of change, any concern. And I also, to address the concerns, I did file this most recent one with the intake through SHPTI, and it is, I want to meet Matt's concern with the analysis that went on in the archaeological site, but I believe that it was at that time that Susan and Stephanie came out that there was no particular further things to do. And I tried to meet them with all the criteria that I set up. The Otsubo Monument Work meets the registration requirements set forth in the submission Kapa'akea Ili, Waikiki Ahupua'a, Kona District, Oahu Island, and that's also commonly called today Mo'ili'ili. The Otsubo Monument Works is significant at the local level under Criterion A, history and events, serving as an incubator for the entrepreneurial dreams of Japanese immigrants to find employment off the plantations and establish their own enterprises and improve their economic status. Under Criterion A, history and events, the Otsubo Monument Works is significant at the local level under A for the discovered events and history associated with the site. And then the period of significance ranges from the purchase of the site in 1923-24, that's because it was December, January, to the death of its owner, Sentaro Otsubo, that was in 1952. The Otsubo Monument Works is eligible for the Hawaii and National Registers of Historic Places at the local level under Criteria A due to its continuous significance in small town commerce and its discovery of events and history associated with the site. And again, these are the two artifacts. And I think that's that concludes what I have. But I would, comment on the criteria that I used, which is listed in the. I'm trying to escape from my. Hang on a second. Sorry. Okay. I don't know if this is on the screen sharing, but this is one of the pages. If it's not, I'll just read it. These are the applicable criteria for research. And this comes actually right from the archaeological playbook, of which I sat in on many classes and continue to sit on classes, although I'm not a professional archaeologist by any stretch. And the methodologies available for research most conducive to producing results were rectifying contemporary map overlays, which I did do, the site-based landscape approach of soil strata, informal coring examples, and soil analysis. I did all of that at the site and also all around the neighborhood to designate the type of site that it was, and it was a non residential site and a non-agricultural site in earlier Hawaiian times. And then documentary analysis from the Bureau of Conveyances, including deed research, census data, business directories, land commission awards, and DAG's Land Survey Division map collection and the University of Hawaii Hamilton Library map collection. And four, phenomenological approach to visual and tactile descriptions of the four artifacts or headstones in a comparative visual taxonomical analysis of form, size, surface, features, and pedestal mounting with other extant headstones of the same period. And five, manufacturing techniques used in the artifacts and labor involved. Other methodologies, which might have produced lesser results for this document, were not considered. They are including linguistic analysis, lithic analysis, radiocarbon dating, coral dating, Cyrax laser scanner, 3D analysis modeling, and patina age dating. I think these are all tools that are available to archaeologists, but in this case, they were not necessary. So I wanted to go over that with you. And what I would like to do is open. Thank you very much for the presentation. I have so much more to say, but in the interest of time, I hope that I have answered as many questions as possible. And I would be happy to answer any of them. If there are concerns or if there's questions, please ask them at this time, please.
Any questions for Laura from the board?
I have a question. Maybe I just missed something, but I'm not sure why they were put in the Japanese cemetery rather than back in the Roman Catholic one.
Okay. Good question. First of all, I'm the co-coordinator for the Mo'ili'i Japanese Cemetery, and essentially it's on the National Historic State and National Historic Registers. And I, along with many, many others and volunteers all, were responsible for putting in the stone wall, for the gravel, for planting the crown flowers, the all of the stonework that's in there, the washing stones and everything else. And there were a lot of stones that were tossed to the side. And these are keikis right over here that had no home at all. They were thrown over to the side here. And so within the cemetery proper itself, we have put stones there. The Roman Catholic cemetery would have required a huge amount of reconstruction at the site and approval by the diocesan board, well, I guess it would be the bishop. And in Honokaa, dealing with the Catholic Church has been a long process to get through to being able to nominate that Catholic properties for the State and National Historic Register, of which it's, I believe, still going through to be put on the National Register. It was approved by your board, by the state. So it would be a very long process to get them restored. They would also have to be restored in this type of pedestal because these are so extremely heavy that they, whether they fell over because of rusting out the pins or the pins themselves were pushed to the side and broke. And in my nomination, you can see the weathering of some of the stones and the others were spalling that rusted out. And so that would not be a practical way or a safe way to restore them there. So I don't know if I've met your answered your questions, Paul, but it was the place of honor that we wanted to place them. And they were used, I should have to say, they were part of the community since the mid 1920s, all the way up until we discovered them in the 20 teens.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
And there are other, it's not just Japanese, it's many other people with different backgrounds that are here. Not all Buddhists, many Christians. So it has extended its openings to everybody.
Thank you. Actually, one quick one. Do you know which stones are in the Oahu Cemetery that Otsubo did besides Kamakau, maybe? Or
No, he wouldn't. Those were the first carving of that was in the when Kamakau died in 18. at 1876, I think. So it was before Otsubo's time. Harriet knows the ones in the Japanese cemetery, but not, maybe not even all of them. But in the nomination, I have the grandparents of Senator Dan Inouye's parents are there. And she definitely, they were family friends. And so she definitely knows they were, as well as her own personal site place. We call them hakas. That's a Japanese term. I do not know. Bamboo Ridge is still, to this day, at least before the virus, we went out every year to have a celebration there of the Bamboo Ridge and its protecting nature of the Jizo figure that's there for the fishermen that are there. That's in, if you go out to Makapu'u, that's where it is. That's the, and then the Hyo Monument, which is across the street from Central Union, which is in the Japanese temple area. Unfortunately, they repainted it with white lettering to make it stand out there. But that was carved by him, and that was another historical memory. It was carved and placed at the, I'm going to get the name mixed up, but anyway, it was the Japanese school that was in the Fort Street area, and it was there up until World War II, and then it was quickly, I think, buried and removed and then placed in the temple afterwards. So those are very notable. And the Founders Gate, I'm sorry, I missed the painters putting globby paint on their carvings. They were beautiful carvings. And the next time they repaint the Founders Gate, I hope to be able to weigh in and get them to clean out the carvings that are there. But they are both in English and Hawaiian. And those were his, those were, I would say, very important contributions. But there's others that were, I think, at St. Andrews and other places that I may have to research on.
All right, thank you.
Okay, any other questions from the board for Laura? Anybody from, oh, go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, just in terms of what you're nominating, you talk about this grid-like foundation structure of which these headstones are components. Is that correct?
I'm nominating the site as being a more general term. The grid structure is something that he just poured in there quickly to solidify the headstones from moving, and they're not a well done stone wall or concrete wall or anything like that, and we don't know the extent of how many headstones actually were in there, because to cut up the 4 to 6 inch concrete slab that was poured in 1963. Is not something that was going to be done, and the contractor said we could not take out the Japanese stone, for example, because it would compromise the integrity of the slab that was there. So that was what we were presented.
But I did talk. Your nomination talks about a structure. What is the structure you're talking about?
I think that was something that you suggested from the last time that we talked previously. It is, because it's part of what he did, it becomes a, if you can call it, a quasi structure. It's sort of like banking up a fish pond stones with something that was extra to keep them in place when the water surges against them or something like that. That's basically the importance of the structure, I believe. Yesterday, I did talk to Paula Signan, who is our titular head at the National Park Service, and he said how the nomination conceptually conveys the significance of what is currently there, and this is what is currently observable and there, and the tremendous historical knowledge and a history of events that is also there. And he said that I know he's seen the earlier nomination, but he has not seen the current one that I presented for this time. And he said it should address the spatial and the archaeological concerns, of which I do believe that I addressed all of them. If there are other ones that should have been addressed, I would, you know, be glad to honor that, and we can make adjustments, whatever. And I would like to ask you, Matt, what other suggestions or concerns you might have.
Well, reading the nomination, you know, you've done a fantastic amount of research. You're going into all these different areas that where this has led you, to Kipahulu, to all these different cemeteries, that sort of thing. But it just seems, in terms of the nomination, those are, you know, those are footnotes. You know, that's a really interesting story. It's like a magazine article, that kind of thing. But in terms of the site, the Otsubu Monument, it's really just coincidence that these headstones found their way there and are laying as part of this foundation. Based on your description, it seems like what you're describing is that's his former work floor. He created this floor with surplus stones and wanted a level surface that he could work on. And that level surface is representative of his work. But the ties to Kipahulu and all these sorts of things, it just doesn't really seem part of the nomination form.
Well, I would like to point you back to the two ships nomination that Susan Lebo presented. This was a year or two back, and in which she did extensive historical research as to the ship, as to the people on the ship, as to the artifacts, and they are left there, basically, but it's through the nomination that we know better and understand better what the shipwreck was and what it was doing in Hawaii waters and so forth. And that's the historical events concern. So this ranges far and wide, and this is the what is left is the two headstones.
This is Susan. Could I jump in?
Oh, thank you, Susan.
So following up, I did provide information regarding the two brothers, but the point about the two brothers is, and with respect to this nomination also, is what is in one sentence the, how does this nomination, or how does this resource, why is it significant under E? What, B, I'm sorry, I'm trying to double duty here. Under criterion A, how does it contribute to the broad pattern of history with respect to Hawaii? In the case of the two brothers, that one sentence would be that the two brothers is one of the whaling ships that came to Hawaii, that whaling was a transformative industry. It was global. It brought Hawaii into the global market. It was a contributor to the huge diaspora of Native Hawaiians abroad. It was a huge influence in terms of new economy, et cetera, change to Hawaii. So, and this is one ship that reflects that based on its location and its history and so forth. So taking that same approach, what is the one sentence regarding the Otsubu that shows how this site and these headstones contribute to a broad pattern of history with respect to Hawaii?
Yes,
I think that's what Matt was trying to mention. And
I think that what happened as a discovery of a site pointed back to the early historic settings, the Roman Catholic cemetery, the place where the people lived, and the historical, going back to the Land Commission awards. So it points back that particular way. And what I would say is, if you had taken, and I'm maybe incorrect on this, you'd taken the artifacts that were discovered in deep sea diving, but left in place, and you had done analyses of each one of them, you might have found some of them coming from China, or some coming from Europe or mainland or somewhere else. And that would be the perhaps the artifacts within the two brothers was the artifacts that we have designated here. And they were moved because otherwise, they would have been buried again and put a slab back, put back on top of them. And I think, I just think that they're way too significant to have been put underground again.
In terms of the two brothers, whether the artifacts are analyzed or not, if they're analyzed, yes, they'll contribute more information about what was there and how they got on board ship and where they came from. But the real significance of the two brothers is that the captain and his relationship to the Essex, to the overall industry, the impact of the industry to Hawaii, impact of Native Hawaiians abroad through that industry. So that reflects a broad pattern of Hawaiian history that's reflected by this one site. So what broad pattern of history is reflected by this particular monument company and monument, the family and these particular headstones?
I would say that in the 1920s, when Mr. Otsubo obtained the property, and basically it was a carve out from the Kumalai Hawaiian family next door. And although it went through a number of property transfers and all. So the Hawaiian community and the Japanese American community were very much in intermingled, although they had their separate emphases, I just put it that way. Perhaps Sentaro Otsubo did interact with carving stones for them, I do not know, because the Kamo'ili'ili Cemetery has all been removed. And we know that the burials were, what burials they could find were taken to the Kauaihao Church. The greater patterns of history have to do with the stones' names themselves and how they point right back to a family that is genealogically connected. And I don't mean just in ways of people who don't know who people are, they actually know the people and they are the connections. It's really the importance of Samuel Kamakau at the head of this to know much more about him, his land holdings, his move to urban or more urban anyway, Honolulu, which was a pattern of the times, which was people from the rural neighborhoods and the islands moving to Honolulu for more opportunities. His conversion to Catholicism, which is also another broad pattern of history, and the fact that these were originally determined for the Roman Catholic cemetery. I don't know, am I answering it completely, or would you like to ask more questions? They are very broad patterns of history.
Can I make a little quick, wouldn't it also be a representative of the myriad small immigrant businesses that existed all over, that most of which are just totally forgotten, you know?
That's right, that's right.
To me, that's an important thing, you know?
This is a history. This is about recording things and preservation through the nomination process. These have the artifacts as the remnants, but the nomination itself, which can be gotten by anybody, you know, off the website or whatever, is the important larger document too. This is about the larger patterns of history and events that are to be commemorated. Yeah, thank you, Paul.
One last thing, just going along with that idea, what's going to happen at that site to remember Otsubo? I mean, do you have a plan for interpretive?
Yes. I have already got the agreement by Harriet Natsuyama, that's the granddaughter of Otsubo, to put a plaque up on the building itself so that everybody who comes by can see where the site is. But I also have plans to put a plaque right here at the front of the two headstones, which would designate where they came from and what why they're honored here too. Those haven't been made yet, but they will be made. And if you know, I mean, I'm hoping that you as the board will approve it for the state and I hope possibly for the National Historic Registers, that will also go on the plaque too. That's all of our plaques in Honokaa say that this on the National Register of Historic Places.
Any further questions for Laura? Anybody from the audience have any comments or questions?
Oh, Katie, you're mute. Unmute, Katie.
Is it working now?
Yes. No, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Looked like it was unmuted. Does anybody else have any questions for Laura? Anybody from the audience? Laura, can you unshare your screen?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you were saying. Yeah.
I was just asking if anybody else had further questions.
Okay, there we go. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. Okay, anybody like to make a motion?
I'll move that we list the Otsubo Monument Works on the State Historic Register and forward it to the National Register.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor of placing Otsubo Monument Works on the State Historic Register, raise your hand. I see three.
Are there people that aren't on the?
Who is the third? Case?
Sorry, I can see Paul Morgan, Bill Sosa, and Alton Okinaka.
Thank you.
And they and may I ask, are you others that are not able to nominate it? What your reasons are, and can we correct these things?
Madam Chair, are we in the middle of the vote?
Yes.
The vote has not been completed. You need to ask for no's now, Katie.
Need to, sorry, what?
You need to ask for the no votes as well.
Okay. Okay, all those who are would like to vote no for placing this on the register, please raise your hand. I see Matt, myself, and Pat, and Nancy.
Okay, can I ask them why the no votes and how I could correct this for the nomination? What are the specific things that I would need to do to correct this nomination?
I see this as an archaeological site, potentially significant under criterion D of the state historic significance criteria before its information potential, this concrete slab. I don't see it as something that's the register, the state of Hawaii register eligible or national register eligible.
And the reasons why? It's because it's under a slab, because it was under a slab. What is the reason? The archaeological criteria?
I just don't think it meets, it's not a significant historic property as far as those go, as far as those standards go.
Well, have I met the standards that I suggested to you in my nomination? Because they are right from the archaeological criteria.
No.
What in particular is not meeting them? I mean, the phenomenological approach, the documentary approach, the site-based approach, the rectifying maps, the content, manufacturing techniques. What is not met? I'll address all of those if you think that there's something else that should be met in the archaeological concerns. but you know, we have other properties. That's why I was trying to bring up the other ones that are have a variance from what might be a narrow definition of one term or another. That's why it's a site, not, that's why it's in A, not in D. That was determined really back when, Matt, when you raised questions, that it was not really a D criterion.
So, Laura,
I disagree with that.
I need to ask all of you, if I can resubmit it, what are the things that are needed to be done that I can do to address this nomination? Because I pointed out five different ones that have very different ways in which they were placed on the register by the SHPD boards. And I want to know what the why the reasons and criteria A is for this very important contribution to the broad range of Hawaii events and history.
Sorry, Laura, I don't think that this should be part of our agenda here. I mean, I know you'd like to understand that, and maybe we can address that in a different setting. You know, you could get some more connection and discuss this with other people about the criteria.
I'm actually asking now on the record is because I need to know what needs to be done. And if you don't have particular reasons for why you did not put it forward, then I need to know and see if I can address them. I'm serious. You know, this was a big project, and it was very, very important to all of the Hawaiian community. All of the, if I had asked the relatives to come in, would that have changed your mind? Yuklin Aluli and Jeff Lyons and Harriet Natsuyama, would that have changed your opinion? If I had the actual direct descendants come in, I mean, I can do that if that's.
I think certainly that our board all votes on, you know, what they read in the nomination and what they hear from your presentation, and if we're able to see the site, what they see. So I think it would be better if we could not discuss this now at this part of the meeting. We need to move on to other nominations, but I think there could be another setting which there could be some discussion further about, you know, what people believe about the significance and how it meets that. So.
Well then, from those people who decided to vote no, would they please give me their best analysis and or evaluation, and I can meet it and address them and meet your concerns? Can I have that? Can that be honored by the people who voted no for whatever reason? It's not archaeology. It's not necessarily. It's not architecture. It's a site. It's a place.
Yeah, I think you can reach out to those people, you know, and potentially to other people who provide this sort of analysis about whether sites meet the criteria. You can reach out to them by email if they'd like to provide you with their reasoning, and they can do that. Thank you. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Okay, we can, let's see, why don't we just take a quick 5-minute break if anybody needs a quick moment, and then we'll come back to the next property, which is 2740 Oahu Residence. So be back at 10:42 or 3 thereabouts.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, just want to make sure our board's here. Pat, are you back? And Paul? You guys can just turn on your camera. Let me know that you're back. Hi, Pat. Okay, Paul, are you back yet? There we go. Okay, looks like we're all back and we can continue. And that will be 2740 Oahu Residence. And that will be Angelica. Yes, okay, go ahead.
Thank you. So we will be nominating 2740 Oahu Avenue. I have prepared a slide to demonstrate the features of the house and showing different designs that make it applicable under criteria A and C. So I'll share my screen now. The Fujioka residence meets the historic register criteria A and C. The house has contributed to the broad pattern of development in the history of Hawaii, as it was built during a time of tremendous growth in outlying neighborhoods of Honolulu in the early 1930s. The Fujioka residence, located at 2740 Oahu Avenue, was built in 1926. The residence is a one-story craftsman-style bungalow with a rectangular porch. The 15,466 square foot corner lot, measuring at 81.4 feet across along Oahu Avenue and 190 feet deep along Cooper Road. The house faces southeast and fronts Oahu Avenue with the yard open to the street. The garage is the only structure to close off the yard, as well as landscaping close to the street corner. The property is located in Manoa, a residential subdivision with tree-lined streets and grassy public front yards, instead of the traditional concrete sidewalk. This somewhat hilly area is an early suburban development near the University of Hawaii Manoa campus. The history of 2740 Oahu Avenue reflects the patterns of settlement and chronicles the saga of the development of Honolulu. The parcel is located in West Manoa area as a part of the subdivision of the Pu'upa'eo, originally part of the residence of Judge Henry J. Cooper, and nearby the terminus of the Honolulu Rapid Transit Company Manoa Trolley Line. It is also Makai of the Charles M. Cook Jr. Kualii home. The 2740 Oahu Avenue parcel land was a portion of the land described and covered in the Royal Patent Number 2240, Land Commission Award Number 3322. It is further described as a portion of lot number 13 in Block C of the Pu'upo'eo track. It was recorded in the Office of Registrar of Conveyances dated July 13, 1925 to Eliza Yates McKenzie. Pu'upo'eo, or the Owl's Heel or Nest in Manoa Valley, was a large tract of land that extended from Manoa Road to Oahu Avenue. It was owned by Judge Henry E. Cooper, who had been once Manoa Valley's largest landowner. He was one of the central figures in the overthrow of Queen Liliʻikulani. His house was a large cut stone residence, no longer intact, located between Manoa Road and Terrace Drive. His 65-acre of land at Pu'upo'eo held its large residence and few ancillary structures. The area that was down below was the site of the fruit orchards, a tennis court, a swimming pool, and a pasture for the small herd of cows. The Cooper children used to use wooden sleds to slide down the grassy areas. In the area they reference as the down below, in 1977 had been cut into houses lots made accessible by the 1903 Manoa Trolley, of which 2740 Oahu Avenue parcel is one. This parcel has been in the family since 1946, and it's in its third generation of family ownership. On July 13, 1946, McKenzie sold the property to Kichigoro Seki and Tom Seki, husband and wife, and was recorded in the Register of Conveyance. It was then sold for $1 to their son, Andrew Yoshio Seki, on April 2nd, 1971. In 2005, the property was placed in a trust by Andrew Seki. It was formally transferred to Mr. Ranald and Mrs. Lynn Fujioka on January 20, 2017. The house was not built to be an extravagant display of wealth or stature as some of the other homes in the areas were. It is set back from the road and has a simple bungalow feel. The house is basically a rectangular in plan with a front porch carved out at the front end of the rectangle. The house area totals 1,635 square feet of interior area. It has 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, including a 1/2 bath, a kitchen, living, dining, and front porch. The spaces are organized in a very straightforward manner. The house is elevated off the ground on wood post and pier. The porch piers along the front are slightly splayed, built of lava rock. At the rear of the house, the bedroom addition displays a different kind of exterior siding and foundation support, which you can see here, if you can see my cursor. The sheet asphalt shingled style roof is wood framed hip roof with deep overhanging eaves. The front facade is compositionally framed by the splayed lava rock porch piers with a center bay flanked by the curving lava rock railings of the steps leading up to the porch. The railing that surrounds the front porch is also made of lava rock. Placed on the front and rear ends of the roof are 2 dormers, which are decorated with wood levers. The center bay is the main entry, which is off center relative to the exterior porch steps and house interior. A double door leads into the house off the porch. The left elevation has a double hung windows and a bay window with double hung along its side. Toward the rear of the house, the kitchen extension has 3 jalousie windows, a 3rd bedroom addition, and has 2 double hung windows at the door that connects the rear deck to the bathroom. The addition of the bedroom at a later time is obvious from the side elevation. The original roof does not extend to cover this addition. Instead, the shed roof with lower slope is attached from the original house to cover the bedroom of the siding. The backside of the house is very close to the second house at the rear end of the property. Given the 2 houses' close proximity, the windows along the backside of the house were kept to a minimum, a deck was built in the bathroom. A significant interior feature is the 10-foot high ceilings throughout, giving it a spacious, open feeling. The living and dining rooms have coffered ceilings with prominent beams running parallel in both directions. Interestingly, the evenly spaced and asymmetrical living room is parallel to Oahu Avenue, but has a significant discrepancies in parallelity to Cooper Road. The door and window framing and cases are also important decorative features of the interior and exterior casings as well, are 5 inches wide. The original double hung windows are framed on the exterior side of the single wall structure, meaning that they overhang the exterior wall by 4 inches, which can be seen here. The sills and other elements of the window frame and casings were made well, and over time, there has been several modifications. Today, the house is in good condition and has a high level integrity. Under criterion C, the house embodies the distinctive characteristics of a type, period, or method of construction. It is significant as a well-preserved late 19th and early 20th century American movement craftsman bungalow-style cottages. The style is an American architectural style and philosophy that began in the last years of the 19th century as a comprehensive design and art movement, and remained popular to the 1930s, into which the American craftsman style has its origins from the British arts and crafts movement and began as a philosophy and artistic style founded by William Morris in the late 1860s. The British movement was a reaction to the Industrial Revolution and was perceived devaluation of the individual worker and dignity of human labor. Seeking to immobilize the craftsmen once again, the movement emphasized the handmade over the mass produced and urged social reform. The American arts and crafts movement shared the philosophy of the British reform movement and encouraged originality, simplicity of form, local natural materials, and the presence of hand craftsmanship. It was concerned that with Enobiling, the modest homes of the rapidly expanding American middle class, a concern embodied by the craftsman's bungalow style. The movement's name came from the magazine The Craftsman, founded in 1901 by designer furniture maker, the editor Gustav Stickley, and was popularized through such national periodicals as House's Beautiful and Ladies' Home Journal. The style is usually associated with the low horizontal profile, gabled roofs, wide open eaves, often with decorative supports. Battered columns, partially panned entryways, wide dormers with more than one window, multi-paned windows, and the use of natural materials. On the interior, there is an emphasis of openness, built-in furniture, and finely crafted unpainted woodwork. The earliest bungalows have been built in Honolulu date from 1909. The style became a popular domestic architectural form in Hawaii from 1913 through 1920s. Hawaii's earlier bungalows built during the teens are characterized by hip or hip gable roofs, while those from the 1920s primarily feature on gable roofs. Despite the popularity of style and the fact that there is a fair number of these residents still stand in Honolulu, only a few have been placed on the Hawaii National Register of Historic Places. In our nomination material, we listed all the houses that have fallen into this category, and of which 30 residences total the Craftsman Bungalow style. Can I answer maybe any questions that maybe you might have?
Does anybody have any questions for Angelica? Any people from the board? I had a couple questions myself. Yesterday, I asked you if you knew about why the garage was considered not to be contributing, because it is over 50 years old. I think it was from the 1950s. And I was able to see the site in person, and it looked like the garage was fairly unaltered. So I just wondered why that wasn't included as a contributing structure.
I think when we decided to place the Fujioka residence as our nomination, we just decided that the main residence would be significant enough to nominate.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I felt like the garage had the potential to be as well, you know, as part of the property. So I think that would be something to consider. Because if not, you know, the house in the back does not contribute, and then this building in the front doesn't contribute, and so you might end up having the part that's actually nominated just be a smaller portion of the site and not the entire site if these other pieces are not contributing. So
I believe in the nomination form, though I don't think we touched on it in our write-up, but for the contributing buildings we did say that there was two, and then
you say there's one contributing building, one non-contributing building, and one non-contributing structure.
Okay.
Yeah. And I actually would probably call it the garage a building and not a structure. But
may I add to that, Madam Chair?
Yes, please, Pat.
A lot of houses in the early 20th century, even after automobiles became more common, were still placed in places as if horses were going to be kept in them, not close to or attached to houses. So in this period, where garages are placed has some story to tell about the history of the times. So I also was surprised that it was not included.
Yeah, and the garage is later, but it's still, you know, and from a historic period, it's over 50 years old.
Right, it's placed on the front.
Yeah, right, exactly. And the other thing I noted is you made a comment in the nomination about The landscaping surrounding the house is also filled with rich history, such as a jabong tree near the front porch. But there isn't any other discussion in the nomination about the landscape. And if you did include that, that would sort of help to show that the whole site actually has significance by including the garage and then discussing the historic landscaping around there. Yes, go ahead, Laura.
First of all, if this is going towards the national, they're going to ask about the parcel, the separation of the property from just selecting one thing, and they will ask you for the information that has to go with those non-contributing buildings and the reason why that one was selected. That we have been asked to do that with the Honeycutt properties on a few of them. And second of all, I don't know, was there a plot plan that was included? Because you talked about the orientation to Oahu and Cooper Avenue and the relation to the trolley line, and that might also be important to the relation of the garage. And Pat is quite right. Lots of the horses and mules were all staged down at the edge of the roadway in the early days. So the plot plan, I would like to see as being historically important and referring to the overall.
There is a current site plan.
Yeah, not the floor plans, but the site plan.
Yeah, there is also a site plan.
Okay, I can't get to it, but I'll assume it's there.
Right. Okay. Any other questions or comments for Angelica? I mean, I think I personally would look at maybe modifying your nomination to include the garage, or consider, I would consider including the garage and then discussing the historic landscaping as well, that it would improve looking at the site, the significance of the whole site and then not just the house. Okay, would anybody like to make a motion?
I move that we defer this nomination until the garage and landscaping is included.
Okay, second from Bill Sousa. Okay, everybody would like to vote yes on deferring this nomination. Please raise your hand. Let's see if we can figure out from Nancy here. She said she was going to try a couple of methods. Whether
go ahead.
Yes. Also,
okay. Nancy's voting yes. Okay, that's seven.
And one more thing that if you're finished with taking the vote, I think you are.
Yes.
It appears that important period. Important. I'm getting says my internet connection is unstable. Can you hear me? It appears that the important period of 1931 to 1946 is not documented at all in its nomination. There's a huge void of the original builders, owners, so forth, from 1931 to 1946. And I think that needs to be addressed.
Yes, to why you're choosing. Yeah, thank you, Nancy. Yes. Yes, to document why you're choosing those dates. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks, Angelica.
Madam Chair, before you move on.
Yes.
I apologize. I was a little late to the meeting. So you may have mentioned this, but we cannot use the chat for this meeting.
Okay.
The Zoom meeting is being recorded, and that is the official recording of the meeting. We cannot capture chat. So please don't use it that way. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, fortunately, we've been able to always get Nancy to be able to connect. Okay, let's see. We'll move on to the John and Mabel Dyer Beach Cottage. That's, where is he? Don, there he is. Go ahead, Don.
Okay, good morning. Yes, the next nomination is the John and Mabel Dyer Beach Cottage, and I'll share screen. Okay, the John and Mabel Dyer Beach Cottage is located at 68427 Crozier Drive in Mokulehia. It was built in 1933, and then the 1946 tsunami did damage to the oceanside wall, and that was repaired in 1950. The builders of the house were Walter Tanabe and Wilford Desjarlais. Walter Tanabe was a general contractor who lived in Wailua. I was just able to find recently, he was the designer and builder of the War Memorial in Haleiwa Park. Other than that, I know very little about him. He was born in 1907 and he died in 1958. And besides working as a general contractor after World War II, he also started a furniture store in Wailua. Wilford Desjarlais was Mrs. Dyer's brother. The Dyers lived in Waikiki and they operated a curio store. It was called Dyer's Gift Shop down on Fort Street Mall. They purchased this property, I just wanted to throw this in. Betty Dyer was the daughter of John and Mabel Dyer, and she wrote a book, Born and Raised in Waikiki, which talks about her life. And in there, she talks some about the house. That's where I found out the information about who the builders were and how the house was built. I guess I should say this first before going further. It's significant at the local level under Criterion C as a good example of a beach cottage built on Oahu during the 1930s in a vernacular manner. Okay, I'll come back. I just wanted to go through the history a little bit more. The whole Crozier track was put on the market in 1924. The Dyers bought this property in 1929. It was one of the smaller properties in the subdivision. And they used it to go out on the weekends as a retreat. And finally in 1933, they built this beach cottage. The beach cottage, they spent the summer out in Mokulehia and first put down the concrete slab. And according to Betty Dyer, they erected a tent on the slab and lived inside the tent and built the house around the tent and then took the tent out once the house was done. So the house is a very modest house. And I think that's part of its significance. Very much a vernacular house. There was no architect involved in the design. Essentially, it's one long room, which is the living room. And then it has pent roofed wings on either side. This wing had one bedroom, which in the late 20th century was divided into two bedrooms. It's a very much, it's a plywood wall, which can be removed anytime. The other side has a kitchen, a bathroom with a closet and another bedroom here. So very simple, typical of a, you know, it's single wall construction and gable roof, easiest form of structure to build. Also associated with the house is the garage and a lanai over here, which is outdoor, which is now used mainly for storing surfboards. But originally the Dyers used this as a place to eat. The house has a variety of doors and windows. Here's a five panel door, which I suspect was recycled from another building. Jalousie windows were probably put in the 50s or the 60s and have acquired a significance on their own. And here you can just see a little closer view of that. And on the interior, you can see essentially it's one large room with a scored concrete floor. The back door has been changed. On the whole, the house retains its historic integrity almost completely. The only real changes were the partition wall in the one bedroom, this rear door, and the kitchen floor has been changed. And then on the garage is completely intact, but they have put in a modern door on it. I think all four of those changes are very minor and did not affect the historic character of the house. The jalousy windows, like I say, have a change their own significance. Here's another view of the Mackay side of the house. Here's the bedrooms on this side. Very simple truss roof on the house, which has this rather unique boxed ventilator, which has a wood door to control the wind going in through the house. And this is at both ends of the gable roof. The kitchen remains pretty much intact as well. It has a stainless steel sink, has its sliding windows. The windows on this side of the house have wood shutters on them, which are also original. The bathroom has a 5-panel door. And again, the bathroom is broken into sections with the toilet in one room, then a shower around the corner, which has its own door going out and an area for changing and a sink. And then the one bedroom off the bathroom is here, which again has sliding windows and very much single wall construction. And then the other bedroom has a casement window, but again, 4-pane. So I suspect it's from the 30s. Horizontal panes came in pretty much that period. And then here's the other bedroom. Here's the partition wall. And the jalousies were, I think, originally probably screened and then they put jalousy windows in. That's my guess. Then here's the rear of the house. Essentially, after the tsunami, they extended the lanai. And both these wings were here originally. The Dyers still own the house. Jennifer Dyer is a granddaughter of the original owners. There was a slight interruption in ownership of the house during World War II when gas rationing was in effect. They did not come out and use the property. And as a result, in 1945, they sold the property to a man who was in the military on an agreement of sale. In 1946, the tsunami struck and the man quit paying on the agreement of sale. And eventually in 1950, the Dyers regained control of the property. And that's when they did the reconstruction here. But again, I think it keeps, you know, it's a part of the story of the house and has a historic significance of its own right. And that's the nomination. It's, again, I think the house has a very high degree of integrity. It's in good condition still. And its gable roof, single wall, is very much typical of vernacular style buildings. I think it's very much typical of a casual beach cottage environment with the outdoor lanai dining area. The shower going into the the door going into the shower, and just the overall informality of the house with one large room, bedrooms off to the side, essentially for sleeping. There are some other house beach cottages that have been registered, including the Mendonca residence out in Mokulea, which was designed by Ray Morris. The Hocking residence in Waimanala, which is a nice stone residence, and Mark Robinson had a large two-story beach house, and there's a number in Lanikai as well. But I think this is a very good example of a small, modest, vernacular style beach cottage and should be considered for nomination. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
Okay, any questions for Don from the board? Don, could you stop? Sure, yeah, thank you.
Yes, figured that out.
Good timing.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Pat.
I wasn't privileged to have a site visit on this property, but my brother-in-law and his wife live right around the corner on Olohio. And so I have been along that way many times. And there's the Salvation Army. There are places that we can probably assume will remain in their character, but along so many beaches, as you mentioned, Don, these really lovely, casual weekend places are getting torn down for large structures. We saw that on Hanalei Bay with the fish house in the last couple of years. So I really appreciate that that there is retention of some of these, because this is classic floors, walls, ceiling, the way it was done with that casual weekend experience in mind.
Yeah, Pat, I totally agree. And I was actually able to see the site, and it very much has that very casual, rustic feeling to it, and appears really quite unaltered. It's really a special little place. Bill Salsa? You have to unmute yourself. You're still muted, Bill.
I never know what to unmute.
There we go.
Hello. No, I'm scared. I really enjoy the house. I know where the house is located. I'm very familiar with the location. And it's a beautiful place. It's the kind of place that once upon a time, I wish I had been able to go in, but you had to know somebody. But I really like the style, the architecture, and the way it is very much blending into the islands.
Thank you, Bill. Any other questions or comments from the board?
I didn't see a picture of the garage. Was that contributing? I couldn't
find it. Yes, it is. I'm sorry. I showed it yesterday.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
But yes, it's essentially a tongue and groove and vertical plank board, garage with, again, a very simple gable roof with a totem roof on top, but simple trusses. And you can see the single wall all articulated, the structure of the 2x4s on the garage.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions from the board? Questions or comments from the audience? All right, thank you. I just noticed a couple of things on the nomination form, Don, that at least the version that I have, it's missing the USGS map. It's just a blank page.
Oh,
you
okay.
Might want to check and make sure that it shows up. And also on the TMK map, you don't indicate which is, oh yeah, I guess you do.
It it's is, the one it's that's very, it's, you can see it's out. A small property. Yeah, it's there, yeah. Blue.
Maybe you might try to make it, instead of making it that one lighter, make it darker or make an arrow or something that's okay. A little more obvious as to which one
okay,
it is.
Yeah, I'll see. That's what the city and county gives me.
Yeah. And then the floor plan that you have in there, the bedroom that's on the floor plan in the upper left-hand corner is not labeled.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that might help, but otherwise.
Okay.
Okay, anybody like to make a motion?
I think Phil's doing it. I know that we accept this nomination to the State Historic Preservation, to the State Register of Historic Places, with the ability to be submitted to the National Register.
I second the motion.
Great. Okay, let's take a vote. All in favor of putting this property onto the State Historic Register. Your hand, please. We'll just, we have six yeses here. We'll just see if we can get a response from Nancy. Nancy, can you unmute and give us your vote? Dr. Downer, can we move on and then Nancy can, if she's able to get on and give us her vote, we can come back to it.
Yeah, we can move on and you know, since she was present, if she, I mean, so it has carried with six yes votes. If Nancy wants to add, you know, send us an email if she can't get on, if she gets us an email today, that would be, you know, I think that'd be more than sufficient.
Okay. Great, thank you. Right, thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Okay. We can move on to some of our other items, the approval of the March 4th minutes. Thank you for sending that to me, Chandra. The only thing I noticed about was that you're still listing Nancy as chair. And then, so I looked quickly at the other ones, and I think also in the September 17th minutes, you're listing Nancy as chair.
Correct.
Okay, my apologies. I'll correct that.
Okay. Thanks. Other than that, I'm just going to make a motion to approve the March 4th meeting minutes.
So move.
Seconded.
Okay. All in favor of approving the March 4th meeting minutes as amended? Looks like we have six yeses there. Thank you. And now we can move on to our discussion of the limited meeting. So first, if somebody would like to make a motion to have a limited meeting on August 5th.
If we're going to talk about making changes, why don't we do that before we have a motion?
Well, I think either way, we'd like to have that on the 5th. And then if we decide to, even if it is in person, you know, or if it's on Zoom, we still have the meeting. And then we could also talk about if we wanted to, you know, spread the other meeting into both days, perhaps. I don't know, I guess we can do it like that if you want, Pat, that's fine.
I'm just, you know, I'm concerned that if we're not actually physically going on site visits, that Thursday meeting that we're calling a site visit is giving us almost word for word what we then hear again on Friday, which seems like an unnecessary duplication. So yes. I rather than having a limited meeting, I would be interested in discussing if it complies with sunshine laws, splitting the next meeting over 2 days, since there are 11 properties that are currently on the list.
Okay, anybody else have thoughts on potentially doing that?
One thing, Katie.
Yes, Don.
Maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I'd like to think maybe in August we aren't doing Zoom. So I think it might be prudent to at least ask for a limited meeting, and then if cannot, go with the route that Pat is saying.
Yeah, I don't know at what point we would be able to change what we've set up, but if right now we set up to have a limited meeting on Thursday and the other meeting on Friday, you know, at what point could we switch and then say, okay, now we're going to spread the regular meeting to 2 days?
Katie, if I may.
Yes, please.
So in terms of sunshine law, so for the limited meeting, we have to get pre-approval from the Office of Information Practices. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
And as long as we have enough time to do that in advance, we can go ahead and you know, we don't have a real timing question. Excuse me. Pardon me. You know, in terms of actually posting the agenda, we have to do that 6 days in advance. But for the, you know, so for the actual business meeting, you know, the splitting the meeting or doing it all on Friday, that, you know, we have a fairly tight time frame for that. The OIP, the Office of Information Practices pre-approval, is a different matter. We need more lead time for that. But you know, if whatever the board does today, we will have plenty of time to handle that aspect of the administrative end of complying with the, you know, the Information Practices Act.
Okay, so I'm sorry, can you confirm then if we right now voted to have the limited meeting on Thursday and the business meeting on Friday, and then at some point decided that we wanted to then instead split the business meeting to 2 days, or at what point would we not no longer be able to do that? Or
we would need to know that at least 6 days in advance.
Because
actually it would have to be say noon of the sixth day, because we still have to get it to the Lieutenant Governor's office for them to post it on the state calendar. And while technically they're supposed to do it, you know, they're open till 4:30, you know, their cutoff is earlier than 4:30. So, but I mean, you have plenty of time to do that.
Okay, so it sounds like we should probably keep the limited meeting on Thursday, just in case we get to the point where we can do in-person site visits, and then we'll have the ability to do that. Okay, so would somebody like to make a motion for the limited meeting on August 5th?
I would, but I can't remember the verbiage.
For reasons of privacy, safety, and security.
Move we have a limited meeting on August 5th for reasons of privacy, safety, and security, to look at the sites that are on the docket.
I second it.
Great. Okay. All in favor of having a limited meeting Thursday, August 5th? Okay. I see six hands. Okay. Let's see. And then Dr. Downer, do you have any update for us on the bill that was at the legislature to reduce the number of people on the board to 7?
Sure. And actually, before we do that, I would like to, as everybody knows, I believe Bill Sousa and Nancy Peacock will be leaving the board after this meeting. And on behalf of the governor and myself and SHPD, I'd like to thank them for their service. Both as members and as chair and vice chair, you know, it's important work, and we appreciate the time and effort that they put into it. Normally, we would give lays at this time, but obviously, I'm not master of Zoom well enough to do that electronically. So, in terms of the House bill that would reduce the number of members from 10 to 7, that passed both houses. It has been sent to the governor. The governor has not taken action on that yet. Since this bill actually originated in the governor's office, I would expect the governor to sign it, which means we will, you know, at the next meeting, as of right now, we will have 6 members with 1 vacancy. We will not have the required Native Hawaiian specialist on. We are actively looking for someone to apply and be appointed on an interim basis by the governor. And, you know, if any of you know somebody you think would be appropriate for that, I would encourage you to urge them to apply. I, as a reminder, the governor will not appoint somebody who has not applied through the boards and commissions website. So, you know, what that means in terms of actual board business, the quorum will be reduced to 4. And, you know, it will also take 4 yes votes to pass a motion. Anybody have any questions on that?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Pat.
I don't have a question about it, but I was wondering if you could give us a little overview of other preservation bills and money and all of the details, having just finished the session.
Sure. So in terms of other bills that affect historic preservation, none of them passed. This is the bill affecting the size of the review board is the only historic preservation bill that actually passed this session. There was a great flurry of action at the beginning of the session. And very quickly, most of those bills just sort of stalled out in committee. Because this is the first year of a biennium, those bills will all remain alive, and they will restart next session at the committee that they stalled at last year, this year. To be frank, I was surprised at the number of bills that were dropped this year that reflected SHPTI and historic preservation, simply because I believed at the outset that this would all be about budget and revenue and COVID and housing. And at the end, that's really what it was about. But at the start of the session, people were lined up. And that was frankly true across the board. It was not just limited to SHPTI. At least within DLNR, there were a very large number of bills that were introduced. Most of them stalled out at some point. And honestly, that's always the case. I mean, less than 10% of the bills that get introduced actually pass. In terms of funding, SHPTI actually fared very well. We did not lose any positions, and all of our positions are funded. And that's a very good thing, because there were divisions in DLNR and in other agencies that had lost staff, had positions cut out of the budget, and in some cases, significant numbers of positions were lost. But we avoided that. Now we are still under a hiring freeze, so that means that we are allowed to ask for exceptions. But to give you an idea of what the exception process is like, it goes through the department and then gets sent to the governor's office before the governor acts on it, on that request. It has to be vetted by the budget and finance office in the Department of Finance. And as you all know, the last meeting, Tanya moved on. That was actually her last day of work at SHPTI. That exception request to fill the branch chief position has been at Budget and Finance for almost 90 days now. Filling these vacancies, even though they're funded, is going to, who knows when we're going to be able to do that. But at least we didn't lose positions. So, it's the news is as good as it can be under the circumstances. Anything else on that, Pat?
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have questions they'd like to ask?
Go ahead, Laura.
Yes, Dr. Downer. Two questions. One, I was surprised by the HICRIS system that has been put in place, which seems to be designed for developers and contractors to use. So for example, the three nominations that were presented today do not really need all of the HICRIS background, and they need to simply form their nominations and send them to intake. Is there a way that you might have simplified the form for people who are just simply doing nominations, actively to change their landscape or their housing or whatever it is to present? That's one question. I have a second question then too. The second question is, it was over a month ago, I asked you about what the status was, because I don't know what happened between SHPTI and NPS, namely that The Wong Brothers store has been on the record for since 2019 or something like that. And the Catholic properties in Honoka have also been on the property. And there have been 45 days that passed the NPS time limit. And since the 30 days, more than 30 days that I asked you, I was wondering if you could do a follow-up on that. Where are those two nominations now? They've gone into some limbo and we don't know where they are.
Okay. So with respect to Hycris is both the front end of our operations and it also manages the internal processes. So, you know, we hear the complaints about the front end. We realize it's not as intuitive as we thought it was going to be when we were designing it, and we are working on that. But the difficulty is that we process everything electronically now. So if something is sent to us, you know, in any manner other than through Hycris, somebody on staff has to do the work of getting it into the system. So we are working on it. I should say, I don't know how long it will take to resolve some of the questions that the people are raising. We do have a maintenance contract with the firm that developed Hycris for us. But, you know, under that contract, we have a limited number of hours we can, you know, that they have to provide in terms of, you know, working on the system. We also have some sort of under the hood issues that are being resolved. And frankly, those sorts of things are a higher priority, but we do understand that, that it is, you know, we have shifted the burden to the people submitting things to us. And that's a reflection of, we just don't, I mean, right now, Julia is our staff in architecture. And, you know, there are things that we just can't get done. And that's unfortunately the way it's going to be for the foreseeable future. In terms of those two nominations, I will have to look into that and get back to you, because I don't off the top of my head know. I don't know if Julia's on. I don't see her on the list of people attending. So I'll have to get back to you on that, Laura.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Then we have our list of 11 nominations that will be at our next meeting. Also, Dr. Donner, will we have to vote on a vice chair?
Yeah, that'll have to be an agenda item for next meeting.
Okay.
And I guess I would also just, you know, this may be something you want to talk about, but it may be a little bit off topic at this point. You know, in terms of when we will go back to, you know, sort of traditional meetings, face-to-face meetings, you know, I think that we could certainly accommodate the board in a face-to-face meeting. I think accommodating the public in a face-to-face meeting right now would be exceedingly difficult, because we are still required to maintain the 6-foot social distancing. You know, I think it would be a little complicated for the board, but I think we could manage that. So until the governor relaxes, further relaxes the requirements on, you know, indoors meeting, you know, indoor activities, we're going to have to be working on that. And, you know, I don't pretend to know. I'm certainly not one of the people who's privy to those discussions at the cabinet level. But I would be surprised if those indoor restrictions get relaxed very much between now and the fall. But, you know, that could all change Monday. There's just no way to know. The legislature did pass, an administrative bill to deal with, you know, sort of hybrid meetings. So that would allow, you know, right now we're operating under the provisions of the emergency proclamation, which allows for the, you know, the face-to-face meetings. But the ledge did amend the, you know, Sunshine Law to allow hybrid meetings where some people would, you know, some board members would be present physically and some would be, you know, on on Zoom or Teams or however, you know, whatever the remote meeting platform is. You know, we have never done a mixed meeting, so I don't think, I mean, we did plan to have one before everything shut down, but you know, it's not clear how complex that will be. Sounds complicated to me, but Chandra will have to do it, so whatever. It's not my problem. So anyway, that's sort of where we are today. You know, stay tuned.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions or comments or discussions from the board? Okay, go ahead, Pat.
I just wanted to follow Alan's thank you to Nancy and Bill. I have learned from both of you, and Nancy, you were chair for a long time, and you have a longer history than that with this board. And I think that all of us appreciate the efforts and the diligence and the expertise that you brought onto the board. So mahalo.
Thanks, Kat. Very well said. Totally agree with you. Thank you, Bill and Nancy.
Yes, thank you, Bill and Nancy.
We'll miss you. Okay, with that then, I think that our meeting is adjourned. Wish you guys all a safe and happy weekend.
Bye.
Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.